We have philosophers of all ages here, from the older to the very young, so yeah. And we're very fortunate to have Professor Peter Redpath this evening, who has a long, distinguished career as a scholar and teacher of philosophy. He's director of the Abner Aquinas Institute and tutor at Harrison Middletown University in Tempe, Arizona. He serves as managing editor of the Philosophical Book Series and executive editor of the Abner Aquinas Institute Special Series of Philosophy from the Socratic Press. Former professor of philosophy at St. John's University in Staten Island, Professor Redpath taught philosophy in the college and university level, as I said, for over 44 years, and is author and editor of 11 books. He's president and co-founder of the International Etienne Gilson Society, former vice president of the American Maritime Society, chairman of the board of the University of Western Civilization, was a former associate editor of the Contemporary Journal, or the Journal of Contemporary Philosophy, where he remains a current advisor, residing with his wife in Lorain and Cape Creek, Arizona. What he's going to talk about, what this book addresses, is something which is extremely important for our time. In classical antiquity, we saw rising crescendo from Socrates through Plato to the genius of Aristotle and his metaphysical insights, followed by precipitous fall in the Stoicism and Epicureanism in latter-day cynicism. After a century and a half of great philosophy, the genius of Aristotle was lost almost overnight. A millennium and a half later, in the High Middle Ages, Scholasticism went from Albertus Magnus to Thomas Aquinas, and in a half century of metaphysical prowess, we saw with that the decline of the nominalism of Duns Scotus and William Ogden. In three quarters of a century, the genius of Aquinas was lost almost overnight. Descartes and later Kant spoke of scholasticism. They didn't turn to Aquinas' genius, they turned to nominalism. Western civilization lost its intellectual glory. If you look at the metaphysics section of any modern bookstore other than the CNS, you find books on Paul reading and Spiritism. In his monumental work before us here, Professor Redpath seeks to reestablish in an initial way the essential connection between philosophy and science, and science and wisdom that started to become centuries ago around the time of the birth of modern science, as I described in this sort of lost review of the genius of the great Aristotle, Aquinas. Because this main life entails reuniting in an initial way, most contemporary intellectuals claim are two distinct natures. Professor Redpath precisely explains what is the single nature of philosophy and science, and how it appear to be two distinct natures are actually one. Toward this end, he re-examines the general history of philosophy and science from the ancient Greeks to the present day. As he engages in the study, he radically reinterprets the nature of philosophy and science, universals and analogy. He challenges commonly received scholarly opinions about the origin and the nature of one, the problems of the one and the many, and universals, and the nominalism which I mentioned. So please join me in welcoming you, Professor.
Thank you very much. I can't tell you what an honor it is to be here tonight, and a most humbling experience. Part of the reason it's an honor for me is because Scott Block's partner in crime, Father C. John McCloskey, has been a good friend of mine for years, and we come to see him periodically here at the center in D.C. while he was here. It's a humbling experience because as Father was going over some of the activities in which I've been involved for the last 30 or 40 years, I started to think of the great experiences that I've been able to have to meet people, to travel with people, to converse with some of the greatest intellects of our time, both Catholic and not Catholic. To travel with Scott Bloch in Poland and Richard Tafara, who was here, studied at the Pontifical Institute of Medieval Studies, to have friends at the Pope John Paul the Second Catholic University of Lublin, to be able to work with Mortimer Abbott to set up the Angelicum Academy and Great Books Academy homeschool programs, to be able to travel to Rome, meet Pope Benedict, to sit out at the Angelicum in Rome overlooking the seven hills of Rome, drinking wine, being serenaded at Mont Saint-Michel, traveling to Venice, spending time with Polo Scott Cristella for a couple of weeks while I was there, having people like Ralph McInerney and Jude Doherty and Father James Shaw as friends. All of that, such a terrific experience. And I was thinking that even with all of these things that I've involved in and done, looking at it all even here tonight, I know that the thing for which history is most going to remember me, or probably the only thing for which they're going to remember me, is that I'm the father of Paul and Peter Redman. Because I know that, for the most part, it's due to my sons that most of you are here. So I will try not to let them down in front of such a distinguished audience. And my son Peter, both of them are very protective. That's one of the reasons why they sit close to me, especially if I'm going to lecture. And Peter warned me, says, "Dad, remember, you're in the chapel." Every once in a while, my Brooklyn background comes out. Most of the time it does, but I get out much of the audience at times. I have to, just. Plus, I had the Severian brothers in high school, and you take the combination of those two and you put them together, and you can never tell what's going to happen. What I'd like to do, in the short period of time I have to talk to you, is just go over the background of how I got involved in this, this work. What prompted me. Before I do that, I have to explain something about the title. An Oxford Elementary Christian Metaphysics. Peter said to me a couple of days ago, "Dad, the title of the book, do you think that some people might find that a little arrogant? That there was this father, Joseph Owens, University of Toronto, wrote an elementary Christian method." I said, "Yes, Peter, I see that. The title's an inside joke. If you knew Father Joseph Owens, first of all, you know that his elementary Christian metaphysics is not elementary. To distinguish it from his, if that's elementary, my work is not elementary. Plus, Father Owens is he's very much like Father Shaw. You don't want to compare yourself. But these people are species unto themselves. Owens is just a frightening man to talk to, because you knew, you had the sense when you did talk to him, 10 rooms shaking his head back there, that he was bilocated. he was somewhere else while he was with you. And you could just ask him a question about, hey, can you know where it was, citations now? He could tell you the page number, the location on a page in text. Now, nevertheless, the work is ambitious. It tends to reunite philosophy and science and wisdom in an initial way. but the reason that I got into this was because of the influence of several people on me. One was Jacques Maritain. A couple of works that Maritain wrote that I was reading in the mid-1980s. I've actually been working on it. I had this project in mind since the 1980s when I was doing an article for a volume called Understanding Maritain, also in print, that was edited by Bill Hudson and Matt Mancini a long time ago. And as I was reading, I was reading The Peasant of the Garonne, and I came across a passage by Maritain in which he said, he begged his readers not to take the statement he was going to make that of a crazy old man when he claimed that modern subjective idealists were not philosophers. Now, I disagree with Maritain on a number of the issues. I think it's easier very often to read St. Thomas to understand Maritain than it is to read Maritain to understand St. Thomas. But nonetheless, even when I disagree with them, I always will respectfully listen to them, because he has these flashes of genius and that lead you usually to some nugget that you never would have seen if it weren't for him. And he also said that modern philosophy, this subjective idealism, was secularized theology. Now, before he had said that, I'd actually come to that conclusion. I had read that there was some sort of secularized theology that people were involved in. Then I saw Gilson. I think it was in the Unity Philosophical Experience where he talks about the subjective idealists not being philosophers. I was reading Mortimer J. Adler, this pre-war generation, and God of the Professors, and Adler was complaining about how in the 1930s, at the beginning of America getting involved in World War II, how the American students, as a result of their professors, were largely sophists and could not defend the principles of Western culture against the onslaught of Nazism and communism. These people talking in this way led me to conclude that there was something to what Maritain said. And so I went back and I started to research this, and I concluded that Maritain was right, that Descartes was not a philosopher. He called them ideosophers. I call them transcendental sophists. Transcendental Thomas and being a kind of transcendental sophist. But as I was working on this, I said, well, if he's right, and I noticed something else too. I noticed that the major thinkers that I respected within Thomism, Gilson, Maritain, Father Maurer, Father Owens, all understood philosophy as done by the ancient Greeks to start with sensation. Gilson in his Thomist Realism and the Critique of Knowledge, or Aristotelic Realism, says that sense wonder is the first principle of philosophy for all time. Not just, for this period of time, that period of time, but for all time. I wrote a series of books in the 1990s related to this. This theme, trying to show how Descartes was not strictly speaking, was not a philosopher, how all of the ancient Greeks were sense realists. I started out with this work called Cartesian Nightmare, then did a work called Wisdom's Odyssey from Philosophy to Transcendental Sophistry. showing how this was the case, that you had this philosophical realism. As I was going over this, I concluded, you know, one of the problems that we have in the West today that prevents us from reuniting philosophy and science is that we tend to think that somehow or other philosophy entered the Middle Ages. And I point out it never really did. At least not before around the 13th century. What passed off as philosophy was actually Christian theology. And Gilson had made a mistake. Now, I have a lot of evidence. I never make claims that where I don't have mountains about it, usually to support what I'm saying. I just want to read you something here from a scholar you'll be familiar with. Just a short passage here. Talking about St. Augustine, who, they were a philosopher in the Middle Ages. They'd enter with St. Augustine, but it took a foothold. Right? He says, the Philosophia Christiana that St. Augustine talks about is nothing less than theology or Christian doctrine, preached today as the Catholic religion. Then in the footnote to that passage, he says, it's useless to read into St. Augustine's use of Philosophia Christiana any 20th century implication of a Christian philosophy distinct from revelation of theology in the scholastic sense of the term. It means nothing more or less than a lived Christian faith. That was Cardinal Ratzinger, who is David Carter Weissart, has this included in a work called Philosophy of the God of Abraham. So that's just one of the supporting pieces of evidence. The other is a work by Armstrong Curtius, European literature and the Latin Middle Ages. Curtius talks about by the 4th or 5th century AD, there were like 6 or 7 competing definitions of philosophy. And none of which really corresponds to what the ancient Greeks were doing. That enters into the later Middle Ages. What actually tends to take a foothold in the Middle Ages is this notion that philosophy is the liberal arts, or liberal arts is a handmaiden to theology. It's not until around the 13th century that St. Thomas discovers that's wrong. That's a mistake. So, if we want to reunite science and wisdom, then what we have to do is first of all understand what strictly speaking philosophy means, and how the ancients understood it. If we don't do that, precisely because up until the beginning of the 20th century, these terms are used synonymously. So, if we're wrong about our understanding of philosophy, we sure would have got to be wrong about our understanding of science. And I think that the reason that Western culture is in such a mess today is precisely because we've lost our understanding in the West of what is meant, strictly speaking, by philosophy and science. In 1947, Jacques Maritain gave a presidential address to UNESCO in Mexico City for a conference dealing with the formation of UNESCO. And in that talk he gave, he had 5 topics that he addressed. One was absolute sovereignty, and 2 was the natural law, 3 was Weltpolitik, 4 was Babelism. And 5 was our reuniting science and wisdom, especially in relationship to technology. And he claimed that if we didn't do this, there was no way in which we could end global war in the future. Babelism, and I think he was talking about, is sophistry and the real politics is power politics. So one of the reasons I was interested in going and doing this research about Marathon and Descartes was to, I was to figure out, well, an answer to this question, how you reunite philosophy and science. And about the same time that Manitan wrote that article, Etienne Gilson wrote an article that was published by St. Michael's College called The Terrors of the Year 2000. It's a great article, which Gilson talks about, I think he wrote this actually, with Manitan somewhat in mind. Because Manitan had thought that going back to the Peace of Westphalia, a notion of sovereignty had entered the West, which was more or less a transfer of the divine right of kings to the divine right of states. I might make right. And Maritime Plan is totally incompatible to hold that doctrine, especially after the Holocaust, World War II, and claim that you are a natural law theorist, that they're contradictory opposites. So you'd have to modify the teaching on sovereignty. Now there were a number of people that were involved in this. Robert Hutchins was also involved in this movement to modify the notion of sovereignty and to figure out some way to prevent a global war from happening. Gilson was involved in it. Gilson was also involved in the San Francisco conference with Maritime to form the UN. Maritime had received from Paul VI at the close of Vatican II, the Benedict Intellectual, you know, showing his importance in the work that he was doing in relationship to a number of things, including this this world peace. Adler was involved in it. And I think what happened, what I'm trying to do here, this book is not a book strictly speaking about metaphysics. It's about the relationship between metaphysics and culture, metaphysics and civilization, especially Western civilization, and how Western civilization is in decline chiefly because if you lose your faith in the first principles, the metaphysical first principles upon which you're founded, then your culture is going to decline. You can't possibly, anybody that's studied the history of civilizations or cultures in the West knows this to be the case. I'm not telling this as news to anybody who's studied Western history. This creed, Gilson calls the Western Creed, and the unity of philosophical experience. We've lost our faith in the Western Creed, including the eminent dignity of man, and unless we recover it, and recover our understanding of philosophy and science and how they can be unified, then our culture is not going to recover from our current situation. And I think what happened to this program that Maritain and Gilson and Hutchins and Adler were involved in the 1940s, was that in the 1960s it got hijacked in universities. And instead of modifying the notion of sovereignty, there were utopian socialists who decided that they wanted to destroy the notion of sovereignty entirely by changing and deconstructing national constitutions. And I think that's been at work since that time. And it's really moved into full gear in our own period of time. A lot of people have recognized, a lot of scholars have recognized that the fight that that we're involved in the West now, and Justin recognized this in the Terrors of the Year 2000, is that the fight is not between the West and other cultures. It's between the modern West and the ancient West. And there's a kind of a hatred for classical civilization that's rooted in the Enlightenment. In this article, Gilson talks about how toward the tail end of
of World War II, after the bombing of Hiroshima, science had made its greatest discovery, or a shocking discovery, I forget which way he puts it, namely that to know has come to mean that we've wrested this from matter, he said. That to know means to destroy. And when I read that, I said, wow, this is very interesting. For a number of reasons, I said, this sounds like Maritain's warning about Machiavellianism. And I started to think, you know, the more I look at philosophical, the more I look at the popular understanding of science today, especially in positivism, but not only in positivism, with respect to people who tend to identify science with mathematical physics, was that there's a kind of cosmic despotism. For years, as I was going through doing the research into what the ancients were doing in philosophy, I was trying to figure out what is it, precisely what is it that is the test for the fact that someone is actually practicing science. And the more I got into this, the more you'll have people who are in the practice talk about empirical verification, which no longer works because of the fact that there are behaviors of entities that are not observable, even in principle, and the fact that verification is an act of the intellect. It's not an act of the senses by itself. It's only to the extent that you sense evidence as a premise, in syllogistic reasoning, that you can say that you're engaged in scientific reasoning. I decided that there was something wrong with that understanding, and that that the mistake, as Maritain had pointed out, happened with Descartes. Now, precisely where did it happen? Well, Descartes moves truth out of the intellect, even though he's famous for saying that truth lies in a clear and distinct idea. Strictly speaking, truth for Descartes lies in a strong will, the ability to stabilize your imagination, so that when you're viewing things, you do so in a fashion that they don't move on, and you can see them clearly. So that's one of the theses of the book. One of the things that Descartes did is he took the will. He took truth and he moved it out of the intellect. In addition, strictly speaking, he has no intellect. He talks about himself as a mind, but what he means by a mind is a multitude of ideas that are connected together in some way by relationship to the idea of God, namely through this clear and distinct idea that he has of himself as a thing which thinks. And he's a nominalist. In fact, all of the subjective idealists are nominalists. Now, how can you possibly get science out of nominalists? This makes no sense. I tried to figure out, well, let me take a look at St. Thomas, see what St. Thomas says about science. And as I did so, I started to see that for St. Thomas, there's such a thing as a formal object. In fact, that in the Summa Theologiae, Part 1, Question 7, his response to Article 7 of Question 1, he's talking about the subject of science. And he says, the subject of science is related to science like the formal object is related to a faculty or a habit. Now, that was puzzling. That's a puzzling passage. And I couldn't understand it that clearly when I was trying to deal with what does it mean by a subject and what does it mean by a formal object. Until I reread Plato. And Father Shaw loves Plato. Recommends that you read it. Especially the Gorgias. It's a wonderful work to read. The Republic, the Meno. But Socrates engages in this discussion with Thrasymachus in Book 1 of the Republic about whether or not justice is the advantage of a ruler or the advantage of the rule. And at one point, the cynic spells Socrates, they go get a nurse to help him wipe his nose, because he thinks that rulers are actually concerned for the welfare of sheep rather than for their own personal benefit. And here occurs, as far as I can see, if not the first, one of the first instances of what Scholastic St. Thomas School call per se predication. Socrates times him says, strictly speaking, or speaking propriae vitae, strictly speaking for Seneca's, the ruler rules for the benefit of the rule, and he's not a money maker, okay, because the chief reason for rule, for the money maker is to make money. They're coming from two different sources. So I just said, oh, I see. The formal object has to activate the faculty, like St. Thomas will say, color activates the eyes, sound activates the ear. And so science has to have this kind of formal object where you have some sort of faculty in a human being activated. Or have it being activated. Now, the subject of the science for St. Thomas is threefold, actually. It involves, and Father Mauer talks about this. He's one of the people that have had an influence me on in this book. In fact, I don't think I wrote this book, actually. It's one of the big reasons why I feel confident about it. I'm very good at synthesizing stuff. I've been doing this since I was in my 20s. I never read people just by themselves. I always read them together. Try to put them in conversation. And after a while, I just see people, other people. The people talk to me out here, and I'll hear somebody else. So I know that. I've heard that before. Where did that come from? Father Mauer says that the subject of science is actually involves the matter being studied, the method, and the aim. It's good. Right? Now, one of the things that Descartes does is he takes habits out of the human mind. For him, human being is just a train of ideas that's somehow unified by a strong will. But where do you get a formal object from if you have no faculties or habits? How do you explain how the individual knower knows? How the individual knower possesses science? If you have a formal object. Especially when you're dealing with practical knowledge. For example, the formal object of the physician is to heal. Right? How do you connect? How do you connect the knowledge of the physician? It's the knowledge of the physician acting on the relatively healthy body that can be healed that creates science. Well, if you have no principle of knowing in the individual knower, how does that individual act? How do you connect the knowledge of this physician? Now, to me, a scientist should do several things. A scientist should be able to tell you the subject matter that the person's studying, the principles of the subject, how that person gets the principles, and why they work. Now, I claim that, strictly speaking, nobody in contemporary science can explain that to you. If they hold on to this popular understanding, say of positivism, or that mathematical physics and science are identical, that they run into this problem. So, say you want to say, well, it's a team effort. We still got the problem. But the team, how's the team going to work together? The formal object, it can be considered in a receptive sense. Like, you've got the power of sight being activated by color, that's formal object. It can also be considered from the standpoint of the habit, or the faculty. You're reacting. So the power of sight, when activated by color, sees. That's the end, in the sense of medicine, for example. Now, if you cut out the faculty of seeing, the habit of seeing from the individual knower, how do you explain how this individual sees? It sets the relationship I read this marvelous passage by Etienne Gilson in a terrific work that is called Painting and Reality. And Gilson is great at Etienne. He's gems like Maritain. Father Maurer does the same thing. Where he says that the only way to unify a multitude is to order. That's quite interesting, you know? Because you find that it's a very popular notion in physical science today that people parade around like peacocks in the physical sciences. It's like that there's no aims in things, no ends, huh? And now, when Aristotle was talking about aims and ends, he wasn't talking about purposes. Frank Slade, great teacher from St. Francis College, in Brooklyn, a friend of Father Sokolowski. Sokolowski's always talking about Slade now. But anyway, how brilliant he is. Wrote an article about this, I forget where it's published, but ends are not purposes. Purposes are ends, huh? Or aims, but not the other way around. Now, if ends or aims do not exist within a multitude, there's no way to transform that multitude into parts of a whole. Now, all science studies part whole relationships. You deny the existence of ends and aims and things, there's no way you can explain part whole relationships. In fact, there's no way you can consider relationships for real. Consider this. Consider the members of a baseball team. You know, like the third base, second. And you ask that person, well, what are you doing here? Well, I'm playing third base. Well, what does third baseman do? Well, I catch the ball. Catch the ball, I throw the ball. To whom? I don't know. For what reason? I don't know. No purpose, no aim. How do you know what you're doing? How do you know what you're doing? How can you be part of a whole that's engaged in the performance of one act? If a person made this claim in something like baseball, then this person's ridiculous. If somebody was in a firm, did the same thing. Why are you here? What are you doing? Nothing. Well, how can you get another whole? Now, essential to any kind of scientific activity is part of a relationship. So, there's no aim, there's no habits, there are no internal faculties, and the subject known in a nominalistic world has no relationships between things. That are universal or necessary, the individual exists. In classical nominalism, like in Occam, or in Protagoras, there might be something outside the mind. Protagoras can influence it by his gift of speech, and transform it. Occam says, well, universals are occultly produced in the mind, but all that exists is the individual outside. So in a nominalistic world, all relationships become fictional. Is it any wonder that the people that hold on to this kind of a view live in a fictional world? If you have no principle of unity within a thing, what are called forms, there's another thing that's celebrated, and there are forms in things, in physical things in the modern scientific view, except maybe mathematical forms, like John Locke will say, primary bodies. Exist in things, but not secondary qualities like color, figure and shape, and number and so forth. They, they're real, and those relationships are real. But especially Berkeley says, well, hey, how do you know what primary qualities? You don't know the secondary qualities. If substances don't exist, how do you explain real relationships? If all you have is accidental characteristics that exist, how do you explain real relationships? Where is necessity? If you take those characteristics of a form of object that St. Thomas identified, they're all gone from modern physical science. And what are you left with? You're left with this notion of science as a system. It's a logical system of ideas. Now Descartes comes out of this Jesuit education, which is heavily influenced by Italian Renaissance. Now, one of the problems that a lot of Thomists have is that they, first of all, don't tend to read Plato. They don't read the Renaissance humanists, the Italian humanists especially. They don't read Rousseau. Now, a lot of people recognize that for Descartes, there's a problem of trying to explain communication between substances. He thinks that there's some kind of substance that he knows outside his mind, but he considers it inert. It's not active. So he can't explain how it can act on the mind that they can know. He thinks that God has implanted in his mind this system of clear and distinct ideas, and that he can come to know it through the strength of his will. Now, in saying that, what Descartes is doing is he's actually, my claim is that Descartes comes out of the Italian humanist tradition. All right? It's very popular among the Italian humanists, going back, starting with Petrarch, who were the Italian humanists who were trying to dislodge the influence of scholastic theology from Catholic education, from universities, and to elevate their status, to claim that there was a true philosophy, an esoteric philosophy, that was hidden, was buried, in the texts of poets, because they really didn't want to read the pagan poets. At the tail end of the Renaissance, rhetoric and poetry. Poetry is studied within rhetoric. And it's up until that time, it's more or less considered the Cinderella of the liberal arts. Why? Because they're reviving literacy in the West. So grammar comes first, 8th to 9th century, 10th to 11th century, up to 12th to logic, Peter Abelard, William of Champeau, and all those things. John of Salisbury. These debates go on, just when they're coming into ascendancy, you got Aristotle entering the West, and they're robbed, and especially at the University of Paris, the undergraduate school of liberal arts, and they can't stand this that's going on. They especially hate Averroes, the commentator on Aristotle, who also thinks that philosophy is a hidden teaching. That is buried in the Quran. Only philosophers know how to read the Quran. According to Averroes, there's a group of people down at the world, they're the poets. Petrarch hates this. How can possibly be poets down at the lowest level? Then are the dialecticians and the theologians, and then philosophers up top. He's going through Plato's divided line here. Now, The Renaissance humanist movement, there's a condemnation in 1277, which Gilson says, condemnation issued by the Bishop of Paris under the auspices of Pope Peter of Spain at the time. Gilson says brought the Middle Ages, a high point of the Middle Ages, to an end. And then you have this ascendancy of a mindset which seeks to bring into the West an Aristotle that's not dangerous to the faith. And it's mainly led by Augustinians. And this Augustinian movement goes back to Augustine, actually, and even before Augustine, to a passage that Augustine apparently gets from St. Ambrose, an idea about philosophy, that it's a hidden teaching that actually is nothing else other than the religion that was given by God to Moses and that was stolen. Or to which I should say Christians have property. And Petrarch will pick this up, and he'll argue and pass this on to leading Renaissance scholars that this is esoteric tradition. There are actually two schools of philosophy, one that developed among the Italians. In fact, even before they came on to this, the Jews in Alexandria were being criticized for being culturalist barbarians, This was before Christianity comes on the scene. And they were arguing against the Greeks, the Romans, who were accusing them of this. And he stole the philosophy from the Jews. And it's nothing other than deconstructive Jewish theology. So Isaac Newton actually adheres to this understanding of science. He thought he was a descendant of the Magi, born on Christmas Day. And he thought that God left clues around the universe for him to be able to. Nobody at Cambridge wouldn't even allow his theological writings to be made public until the 1960s. And when I think Gilbert, John Kenneth Gilbert, his hold on a bunch of his hands on watching them. So Descartes thinks this. He started to take away from the poets. He doesn't like the poets. The stuff that Paul came out, he studies with the Jesuits. That's the garbage. Stuff is really good. That's a lot. Philosophy's logic, but it's got to be enlightened logic, systematic logic. And he can, America's got this great book on the dream of Descartes. We haven't talked about how Descartes thinks he's going to unite the whole of the sciences. He's got this encyclopedia as part of it. And he's got this book of poetry, this dictionary. He's gonna bring the two of them together. So I said, look, it was not influenced by my Suarez, even though he's a major thinker. His understanding of philosophy is his. It's a hidden teaching that Rousseau recognizes that Descartes can't explain communication between substances. So he says obscure ideas are real. They're true. Just like humans are, and science is not some sort of system that's been incomplete in the soul. It historically evolves and progresses through the idea of tolerance. You come into conflict with the emotions. You project your emotions, come into conflict with your emotions. In three stages. You go from this kind of poetic state, you might say. You know, when you're just kind of like liberty and so forth, and it's unbridled. And then you progress to this civic stage, a moral stage. And then finally you progress to this final stage of a civic being. Now, actually, he's taking a battle with this. He got influenced by a better way. He took Petrarch somehow or other. Now, Justin says this. The reason the revolution in the Middle Ages was best is that Father Shawson. That's what I told him. It just happened to me. This is great. I need this. There's a direct line from the better way to the rationalism of the 18th century, 17th, 18th century. And I said, well, it's Rousseau. And what Rousseau does is he takes the notion of there being one intellect for the entire human race, and he combines it with Descartes' notion that truth no longer is in the intellect, it's in the will. But it's not been completely given there. It's in strong will that grows and develops. And there's one social will, like prayers, and one social intellect. And this becomes the general will. So what we're fighting against in the modern world, in the modern notion of science, is metaphysics that underlies modern science. Metaphysics that always underlies science. And I claim that what it is neoliberalism. And unless we understand that, we don't understand the enemy. When I finished this book, I started thinking, well, there must be some way I can explain to people what this understanding of science is. And I finally came up with that it's socialistically enlightened. But this is the bottom of the stand. It's socialistically enlightened and mathematically restrained and measured efficiency of will. In other words, I prove to you that I'm scientific because I can destroy it. I can build it. I can use mathematics to do it.
I read that text and I said, oh my God, that's Paulus. He's talking to Socrates in the Gorgias. And he's telling Socrates, he's telling Socrates. Socrates is saying, is Marco Rallis really a happy man? Is he powerful? And he says, yeah, that's what he can do. And I'm telling him about it. You know, Socrates says, Paul, I told you I found this magnificent weapon. I could take it. And I could use it for anything. A dagger. So Socrates says, well, what? What happens if you're a fool? But I have to know how to use this technology. Can you really claim that that's science? In other words, you take knowledge and you divorce it from wisdom. How can you possibly claim that you have science? What good do you contribute to human beings, to yourself, and to the world? Okay. So, that in brief is a number of the things that I discussed.
You talked earlier about Dave Martin's ideas with respect to the imagination. How do you think the role or the purpose of the imagination for human beings changed from the time of the Enlightenment onward?
Under the influence of this distrust of reason, the imagination becomes the principle of from which that is chiefly identified with reason and practical reason, because it retains its innocence. It's somewhat like Adam in the garden. In a state of innocence. So, to the extent that the Enlightenment thinkers talk about pure reason, what they're really doing is talking about the imagination operating under Kant's notion of universal will with pure will. And so they understand metaphysics. To be more or less projections of the imagination. This is what Kant's three critiques are all about. Dreaming impossible dreams, so that you know the limits of your imagination, transcendental imagination, and so forth. So the poetic imagination really becomes the principle of the formal difference of a human being. To the extent that you're acting under enlightenment. For example, that definition I gave of science. It's very important. If you're above a mountain, don't go to the human climate change meeting and claim that you hold a different view. Because you only have a scientific view to the extent you can mathematically demonstrate what you're doing. And it's approved by a small number of beings, human beings, who established a normalistic understanding of what the truth is. We've entirely moved the liberal arts out of higher education as a hidden education, and we replaced it with the notion of commerce, being able to receive from the Illuminati. What is the commonly received view that's hanging out in the Ivy League University and in Brussels? We don't accept that. We can't be possessed. It's not your background. You must be Catholic.
Professor, thank you again for coming. Peter, actually, when he invited me to come to your talk here, he actually promised that you could give one space on Kata.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I would do Kata. No.
Not Chavez.
can you comment, really, on the recent development in modern science? And you mentioned something about modern understanding of science is positivistic, right? Positivism. I guess, you know, nowadays, you know, in cosmology, you know, we have this understanding that, you know, our common sense universe constitutes like only 4% of the world of the universe that we know. The rest 96%, you know, is still you know, dark matter or dark energy, you know, we don't know what that is, you know, and then you have, you know, in particle physics, you know, all the smart scientists at CERN, I mean, it's about a matter of verifying, you know, the God particle, right? Because they thought and all open and all that. So, you know, so this reality is with us, you know, and you know, you're making the remark that that this is a type of science that, you know, we produce knowledge, but not necessarily wisdom.
Right.
But, you know, but you have this reality. You know, can you comment on what does metaphysics from the Thomistic point of view have to say about all this reality for us?
I think that if you, first of all, it gives you a better understanding of how sciences actually operate. The principles of science, of any science, are contained in definitions. And now, which constitutes the truth conditions in the science. For St. Thomas, the ancient physicist verifies judgments. But science concludes in judgments. You saw at the same point, you're wondering about something, and you're wondering about opposition. You're wondering about something that you see that doesn't correspond to what you're thinking. And you're trying to figure out how to get this opposition, how do I explain this. Right? Now, if you think that the only way you can verify is by going out to your external senses, right? Well, that's what we do in physics, okay? In classical physics, and even if you're a mathematical physicist, you'll use that. But the uniqueness of contemporary physics is what the thinkers like Galileo and Newton started to recognize was that you could understand and measure qualitative changes. Using mathematics, and that's how they developed the calculus to do this. But mathematicians, strictly speaking, can't study motion. The only way they can study is by stopping the race and plotting. And they do it, modern physics, in a straight line, a deviation from a straight line motion. But mathematicians verify in their imagination. Why? Because the quantity is not directly observable. It's not the formal object, you know, the sense of sight, which is the chief intellectual sense. For you to be able to hold together an understanding of something like a straight line, you have to use you have to remember, which for St. Thomas, strictly speaking, is what we call the imagination. You've got to hold together in your imagination. So this is why mathematicians use models to verify things. That's strictly speaking not mathematical. That's not empirical verification. But in either case, what you're doing is you're taking a multitude. This is the point that I'm trying to get at. The whole philosophy of the ancient Greeks was a study of the one man. This was not a problem that was restricted to ancient physics. The notion that it was is a myth that comes out of the modern reinterpretation of classical philosophy to maintain that philosophy begins with the discovery of logic, but actually it preceded the discovery of logic. The problem that we're going to make goes through from the ancient physicist is all throughout Plato. And Aristotle's metaphysics is chiefly studying the relationship between the one and the man. As is his understanding what science involves, because science is the study of opposition. And according to Aristotle, the chief opposition is between the one and the many. And scientist studies a multitude of opposites within a genus. For example, politicians study war and peace. Physicians study health and disease. The economists study wealth and poverty. That's the subject matter. The relatively healthy body is the genus. That the philosopher studies. The genus of a logician is not the genus of a philosopher, as St. Thomas. It's different. Okay? It's the generating matter
the generating matter. To give an example, Socrates, Galen, the physician, is the genus through which all the medical acts of Galen proceed, all the species of medical acts. He generates. The notion of genus actually started, we got it from this, from the ancient physics. It wasn't from logic, it transferred over into logic. So if you don't understand that what the genus is of a science, you can't understand what analogy is all about, for example, and why analogy is essential to scientific reasoning, but we don't want to use it, strictly speaking. We want to use univocity. And now, analogy is strictly speaking not about terms. As Fuller Maurer says in his work on William of Ockham, it's chiefly about judgments. Unequally relating a multitude to some chief subject that possesses what you're talking about in its form, health chiefly exists in the human body. But you can talk about health books, you can talk about exercise being healthy and so forth. But the analogy is not about a term. It's not judgment that you make in the way multitude is related to some chief subject that possesses something in a maximal way. So there again, do you understand the necessity of engaging in analogy? And now analogy is crucial to developing science, is quite important.
Yes? Last question.
Thinking about what you just said about essentiality of analogy and then going back to St. Thomas, is the connection between science and wisdom so strong, just as a natural man, that there's almost something natural within a human to say, I need to make a judgment about this. So it's unavoidable. And so even for a sophist, I mean,
you hear
in the academy all the time, oh, well, we want to approach the subject without judgment. I mean, that cannot sustain.
Of course not, because they engage in behavior contradictions all the time. In relationship to this, and then, you know, when you get people who reduce the whole judgment that relates to truth to just sort of put Benedict warns about this, you know, in his Regensburg address, his Catholic University address, how, if you are a secularized fundamentalist and you are holding on to this narrow view of reason, how are you going to tell the Muslims to think the same way you do? You need some kind of a trust in a natural reason, which you can consider to be in some way scientific, if you're going to engage with people in a conversation where you can get to agreements without war, without physical conflict. You get rid of the classical understanding of philosophy, and this becomes impossible. Now, I maintain that philosophy and science both are concerned with the problem of the one and the many. I was lucky enough, I had an office with a Dominican priest by the name of Charles Bonaventure Crowley, who was a very interesting guy. He was working for 50 years on the trying to show how all of the principles that are used in modern physical sciences are analogous transpositions of the principle of unity and its properties that are contained in Aristotle's Metaphysics. Now, Father Crowley got, I was not interested in physical science at all. I loved geometry, but then I was working on other stuff, and he came down with spinal arthritis and couldn't figure out how to do this. This work, and the work lacked total unity. The work was a mess. The Dominicans in the House of Dominican House of Studies didn't want to touch it. I said, look, I'll fix it. You publish it, okay? So he writes this work called The Aristotelian Thomistic Philosophy of Measure and the International System of Units, SI. Now, then there's a subtitle to it, which I won't even go into. but he shows me, the whole physical science is a study of the relationship between a one and a many. And all the principles are mathematical principles showing how mathematicians distort the reason about these
these differences that they notice, and the conflicts that they notice. So I got so proud of, oh wow, that's the one of the many in the sign over there. And I got to reform it now with the notion that that science, strictly speaking, but saying that's not a system of buying out, but it's a habit of the mind. And I said, well, I've got to get Crowley to put them out over here and put them together. Then I got to put them together with St. Thomas over here. And have both of them talk with St. Thomas. Now, St. Thomas talk with Plato over here. And then if you put all of those people together, like St. Gregory of Tours said, you stand on the shoulders of giants, and what you can come up with is a metaphysical foundation for a new understanding of science. Which will enable physicists to liberate themselves from this kind of, from this kind of narrow understanding which restricts the way that they can practice their activity. And that's what they'll have to do if there to be any more volumes in this series.
Thank you so much for this.